Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Visualize an owl. She's 20 yards away sitting on a branch. She's pale gray and her neck feathers fluff in the breeze. You begin to walk past her and her great yellow eyes follow, her head turning as you move. Then she takes flight and with silent wing beats disappears. We humans are fascinated by owls. Their images grace Egyptian tombs, ancient Greek coins, and French cave art. Very luckily, they are still with us, and the Rocky Mountain West is rich in owls. Denver Holt studies them. He is president and founder of the Owl Research Institute in Montana's Mission Valley. Denver, it's a pleasure to be here at your Owl Center.
Thanks, Brian. Nice for you to come. I appreciate it.
What was your path to owls?
It all started back at University of Montana, coming out here, being interested in actually history and wildlife.
Coming out here from?
From Massachusetts, the Boston area.
All right.
And probably about 1980 or 81 or so.
And how did you come to choose to come to Montana?
I was sitting in the street corners hanging out with my friends, as we usually did, and somehow I came across a book, The Journals of Lewis and Clark, written by Bernard DeVoto. And I just kind of chipped away at it, and it just interested me. And then I started reading more about the fur trade in the West and American Indians and wildlife. And all of a sudden, everything was leading towards kind of, you know, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, but the West and Northwest in general. And then I just kind of took a chance and came here, you know, with an interest in wildlife and history, the fur trade in particular, or frontier life. Just remember trying to get on wildlife job back in the early 80s or so, and the big species then that people were interested in were bald eagles, peregrine falcons, grizzly bears, and wolves. And so it was very difficult to get on and to volunteer and things like that. And one day some kid from the university had come to class and said he'd seen an owl in a tree near his house, and he thought it was nesting. It was sitting in a hole, a cavity made by a woodpecker, I believe. And so a friend and I went up there to look at it, and there was actually two species of owls. There was a solid owl nesting up high and a pygmy owl nesting low in the same tree. We thought, well, this is kind of neat, you know, and so we sat on it and decided we'd skip all our classes for the rest of the semester and just watch it and take notes with no guidance. We couldn't get anyone to help us out or anything like that.
And now, your major at that point was?
My major at that point was history, but I still was taking as wildlife and history, but I was registered as history, but definitely moving more towards wildlife.
So you didn't have any coaching. You're out there taking field notes.
Right, no coaching, yeah, and trying to get some to help you was kind of difficult. And so I, Billy Norton, we just sat there and just kind of wrote everything down we observed or heard. And then we published a paper on it. And we published two papers on it, actually, but in peer-reviewed journals. And we were juniors then in wildlife and history, and for me, and wildlife for Billy. And then I just thought, boy, owls are pretty neat. There's not a lot of owl researchers out there. Maybe we can make some contributions to the literature. And even back then, I thought, you know, most of the wolf and bear stuff and bald eagles and peregrine falcons is pretty well done.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there's some new things to gather, it was just wide open for owls. So I kind of, and I liked them. They were kind of good looking, you know, and handsome birds. They looked a lot like people with the flat face, the forward-facing eyes, the kind of, you know, nose similar to ours and, you know, big round head. And I do think that's even the appeal today, why so many people like owls.
Did you get your degree in wildlife? Is that where you ended up?
No, actually, I did get my degree in history, but I ended up in wildlife, working wildlife jobs for a number of years after that. And I applied to grad school, and I didn't get in.
Never went back?
No, I had an option to go to another place. I didn't want to leave Montana. And so I just started the research institute after several years of working wildlife-related jobs for agencies and BLM, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife.
So what makes a guy decide to strike on his own and start the Owl Research Institute?
Well, for me, personally,
yeah.
You know, I don't know about others, but for me, what I observed, and, you know, this it's really kind of hard to throw it all out there, but my chances of being a field researcher were very, very slim. If you got a job with an agency, got a job with the university, it just you just weren't going to get outside much, you know, and everyone I saw, my profs, my friends who worked for all the federal and state agencies, no one really got outside much, and I just wanted to be a field researcher. And so I said, well, what are my options? And I worked a little bit with some of the nonprofits like Mass Audubon, Nature Conservancy, Heritage Programs. And I find there was a little more flexibility there, and I like that. And then one day with more guts and brains, I talked to a few friends. We started a board, and I started the Owl Research Institute 20 years ago today. And it's been actually very successful.
Successful how? How do you define that now after 20 years?
Yeah, without trying to toot our horn too much. I think it's been successful in the fact that, one, is we're alive after 20 years.
Yeah.
We're still able to raise money to do research projects. We have written a number of pieces in various mediums. So our children's books have done real well. We have two of those. We've gotten good reviews on those, where we take science, bring a school teacher in, and let them present it, and we kind of provide the information. Some of our professional papers have won awards, either our students or ourselves, at professional meetings. Even New Discoveries in Science, and one of my first graduate student's piece, actually, which we helped her get established.
When you're talking about papers published by people working with the Institute, including yourself?
Yeah.
Now, are these peer-reviewed or not peer-reviewed?
Yeah, almost all of them are peer-reviewed. I mean, there's certain papers that you publish in popular media.
Yes.
Like Montana Outdoors.
Okay, but your scientific papers, the reason I'm asking is you have something called the Owl Research Institute. It's a 501c3. You raise money. Sure. You pride yourself on research. One of the tests of the quality of the research, I'm assuming as a layman, would be you're published in peer-reviewed journals and people take the work seriously.
Correct. Yeah, we're published in many peer-reviewed journals.
In terms of then the research component, which is serious to you, you get out in the field yourself, you're doing field research, you're writing about it, and it is being taken seriously by the scientific ornithological community. Is that fair?
Yeah, well, that's what you hope. The fact that one of our papers in the past several years was picked up as New Discoveries in Science, you know, researchers from Montana have this, I think is fairly serious. Matter of fact, recently, Caroline, our developmental director, and she's an internet person, she said that the last paper we just had published in one of the journals was in the top five most read papers of this issue or something like that. And then you get requests. Another measure of it, I think, professionally is when you get requests from people all around the world. We've had requests for our papers from over 40 countries, from, you know, the peer review journals, and probably 40-plus states within the United States.
Now, why would that be? Are the owls that you're writing about international? So let's say you do snowy owl and the Russians are interested, or what?
Yeah, some of it is something like a snowy owl is circumpolar, so it's in Russia, it's Scandinavia, it's in, you know, North America. So there's a general interest there. And sometimes the papers are just of interest to people. Oh, over in you know, United States they found this, and over here in Europe we have a similar species, or this is a good idea and we're looking at similar questions. So I think it's just maybe a general interest. And then, you know, there's not a lot of owl researchers in the world, and they tend to want to be up on most species. So I'm interested in what's going on in tawny owls of Europe or fish owls of Japan.
How about yourself, your own research now? You've been at it for 20 years in addition to running the Institute, and we'll talk about the Institute in a minute. But your personal research, you said you started because you didn't want to be behind a desk. You wanted to do research. What species have you spent a fair amount of time researching?
Well, here in Montana, our longest ongoing study is starting its 23rd season this year, and that's on long-eared owls, which is kind of a secretive species that lives in little thickets and gullies. And so that's been going on, you know, like I said, 23 years. Our snowy owl project in Barrow, Alaska is entering its 18th season this year. Our other projects with some of the cavity nesting owls all have 15-plus years of data, although it's hard to accumulate large numbers with those smaller species because they're difficult to find. So I have my personal projects, and then students that work with us, we give them aspects of projects. And then I have a grad student now, for example, who's taken off working on flammulated owls. So we must have 7 or 8 projects going on right now, most in Montana.
We are talking with Denver Holt, who is president and founder of the Owl Research Institute, located in the Mission Valley in Montana. Let's take one of those, either the snowy owl or the long-eared owl. You've said there are not a lot of owl researchers. In the case of the long-eared owl, you said you'd been looking at it for 23 years. So I'm going to ask you, from your research, what is known now through your research that people didn't know when you started about the long-eared owl? Is that a fair question?
Yeah, I know. I think that is fair. Some of the stuff is pretty basic. You know, I mean, someone who does a study can say they lay 5 eggs. Yeah, or they lay about 5 eggs is what we find. Some of the other stuff, though, the mark recapture, that's where you get really neat information.
What is a mark recapture?
That's when you band the birds and you put a band on their legs as a marker. Some people do other markers. We just do bands. And then you can find out things like, you know, longevity. How long do they live? Are they returning to the same site? Are they mating with the same individuals? How long is that residency going on? Are their populations going up? Are their populations going down? And that's where the long-term data sets are really helpful. We don't do long-term biology anymore, for the most part.
You say we. You mean as a culture?
As biologists and field researchers, we're more into like short-term seasonal things. And so our long-term studies right now can tell you things like, okay, even though there's population fluctuations in the long-eared owl numbers in western Montana, the trend seems to be going down. But in really to do trend analysis, you need 20, 30, 40, or 50 years of data. We have 20-plus years, but we're starting to see something which kind of suggests that, yeah, the numbers fluctuate from year to year, but the line seems to be going down. And that's the value of long-term. That's the value of marker recapture and knowing individuals. We're learning things on, oh, sure, you know, the male might return to the area, but we know that females tend not to return to the areas where they were born. Information like that, again, having marked individuals, long periods of time in large data sets.
You said something that rings a bell. We recently did a show with two turtle biologists and a rancher that are cooperating on research on the Sonoran mud turtle. And the turtle biologist, the lead guy, said the same thing you said, that our scientific community or the research institutes, whatever, not supporting a lot of long-term research, which surprised me because it would seem to me that if you want to know where species are going, whether or not they're in trouble, as well as learning about them, these things take time. So why is not long-term research fundamental and even dominant in your experience? What's going on?
No, I think we're just caught up in the fast pace of the world. You know, we really need to go back to the academic system, and we need to have the academic system make the adjustments there. We kind of funnel graduate students in and out. You know, they work basically 2 to 3 seasons, get a master's, get a PhD. And these aren't years. These are seasons. And then they move on to become whatever, administrators or maybe take on research positions. There are some long-term studies. They tend to be mostly in game species. So maybe it's elk, for example.
Because in game species, there'd be money by hunting licenses.
There's money behind it, right,
okay.
Exactly. So that's one of the things. That drives some of the long-term stuff. When you do find the long-term studies, like those turtle researchers you're talking about, very often it tends to be people that are just very passionate about it. They find ways to raise money on their own, and they make the contribution that we really learn a lot about. As I get older, I sometimes wonder now, wait a minute, how are we managing our natural resources on a bunch of young graduate studies? And not the graduate program is good. It's important to learn the scientific methodology. But to take that data and then maybe use that to manage natural resources, you got to start thinking about that.
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard that before. In other words, a lot of the research, I'm hearing you say, is done by graduate students as part of their academic process, but by definition, it's short-term snapshot stuff.
It is short-term snapshot. You know, it doesn't mean we don't have great people out there. It's just that we're not allowing them to continue with the same project. And I think I said this in the newsletter, and I'll briefly say it. People who study cognition, researchers who've done it for a long time.
Cognition
mean learning,
okay.
Learning abilities.
Okay.
They tell us that it takes approximately 10 years in any endeavor to become an expert in your field. And so if you just go out there for a couple seasons, and really only 6 to 8 weeks per season, and then you're going to be managing these resources based on that data, I think we just need to look at that again. And I would really like to see us take those graduate students and make them part of long-term studies with just certain aspects of it. And we do have some of that, perhaps not a lot of that.
But that takes long-term funding from someone, either foundations, wealthy people, or the government.
Right. You know, we don't see it except for a high-profile species.
Right.
And then you might see it, whether it's endangered species or, like I said, game species.
Still grizzlies, wolves would be an example or that right. There's money for.
And you're seeing more and more nonprofits or NGOs like what we do here starting to take the lead because they are doing long-term studies. And people are starting to do things that they want to study. And so they're finding unique ways to raise money, whether it's through foundations, corporations, et cetera, to continue long-term studies on animals that interest them.
Okay, let's talk about the Institute then. This is a vehicle that's been in existence for 20 years. How many staff have you got? How many seasonal people? What's your budget? So we get a sense for the size of this thing.
By what we produce, people think we're huge. They think we have 5 or 6 or 10 people working. But generally, we have about 2.5 to 3 full-time people when it's going good, and maybe up to 6 people when we have a lot going on in the field, particularly in the summertime or during the breeding seasons. And I want to keep it that way. I want to keep it manageable because I think if it gets too big, all we're going to be doing is just raising money just for infrastructure. We want to be in the field. We like to say we're kind of the last of the old-time field biologists.
Now, I'm going to read into this. that you want to be in the field, selfishly speaking. You want to be in the field. If it gets too big, you're going to be stuck behind a desk, which defeats what you started out. Now, is that a fair deduction?
That's totally fair.
Okay,
you know, if
good.
I was to say I'm doing this for a greater cause, you know, I mean, honestly, in the end, you are. But at first, you do it because you like it, because you think you're so passionate
yes.
about it. And that's why you set it up, because I know that I'm going to dedicate my entire life to this until I fall out of a tree or fall off an iceberg or something like that. And so that's what keeps me going. And as you said, if it gets too big, mm-hmm. all we're going to be doing is managing people, going to meetings, reading this, reading that, which is what all my friends have ended up doing pretty much mm-hmm. in our business. And I still like to climb trees, you know, and go through the brush. And I can still do it as good as some of the young kids, although I can't run as fast as them anymore.
Depends if you're running after something or away from something.
Okay.
Now, what's your annual budget, and where do you get your money?
We get all our money from foundations. The budget, in its heyday when we were trying to, you know, raise more money, it pushed about $200,000, but now we're probably running in that $125,000-$150,000 range or so.
Per year?
Per year. Yeah,
with
it's very small
people,
for what we're doing, yeah.
But that's a low budget in terms of what people get paid.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so we all take a minimal salary, you know, I mean, you know, I work kind of round the clock, but everyone else just works when we can, and we raise money for the projects as we can. Go to the website. You can look at the productivity.
What is the website?
www.owlinstitute.org.
www.owlinstitute.org. You mentioned falling out of trees, etc. Owls are predatory species. You ever have any trouble with owls in your research?
It depends how you define trouble. Well,
or they
yeah,
didn't I, like I, you being there, I guess.
Yeah, they don't like you being there. Wildlife research is an honesty. I mean, it's wildlife harassment to a degree. And so we go out there and we have licenses to do research on animals. And a lot of times they don't like it. And so, yeah, we've been hit in the heads and the back by, you know, owls defending their nests, in particular snowy owls. Some of them can be particularly aggressive at their nests.
They're a fairly
research.
Large bird.
Yeah, they are. You know, I mean, females are larger than males. They probably push, you know, 5 pounds, 6 pounds, males 3 or 4 pounds. And when they're flying in at whatever, 20 miles, 25 miles an hour, and they hit you in the back of their head, I mean, yeah, they definitely can cut you open. And so we've had that occur.
All kidding aside, they have big talons. Do you have any risks in that? Do you have any incidents with your people getting hurt, or they onto you or anything?
You know, you just kind of like get used to it, and you just got to know when to duck. And that's that. You still get hit even when you duck. I mean, sometimes you're just laying down on the tundra and there's nowhere else to go. And the owl just keeps coming and grabs hold of you and goes right through your coat and scratches your back up and sometimes your head and pulls your ears and things like that. Some are just very, very aggressive where you can't even go to a nest alone. But they're defending their chicks. They're defending, you know, their investment there. And they don't know we don't mean them any harm. They don't know that we're researchers. And so we leave and they get just right back to business. It's really pretty amazing. You know, they're all upset. They're all stressed out. And they come in and they hit you and they whack you and they bark at you. And then you measure, band, do whatever you need to do, race off or walk across the tundra. And the owl goes right back to the perch. And a little while later, it's hunting, bringing food back to the chicks. Like it's all forgotten.
We are talking with Denver Holt, president and founder of the Owl Research Institute of the Mission Valley in Montana. You mentioned earlier what I'll call popularized information, children's books. Some conservation organizations devote a fair amount of energy to mass media outreach, books, television, that sort of stuff. You?
Yeah, I think that we're constantly doing that. Every day there's like an email or a phone call, a request. Can, you know, we go out in the field with you guys? Can we do this and that? So, yeah, we've done the children's books. But the key to something like that is bring in a professional teacher. We can provide the scientific information, but bring in a professional children's teacher to work with. Provide them with the information. They can put it into a context that can be understood by children and up, and then we can just check it for accuracy. And that's why I think our two books have been so successful, and our third one will be as well.
Help me understand that. What's the teacher's role in a book? Does the teacher write the book?
Oh, yeah. We set it up with these teachers where we provide all the scientific information about these species or whatever we're talking about. And then the teacher takes it and puts it in a context. And then we work together to make sure that it's accurate as far as the scientific knowledge is concerned. And the teacher makes sure that it's presentable so someone can understand without too much scientific jargon.
So who does the publishing? And normally in publishing their revenues, how do you divide that up? I assume some of the money comes back to the foundation.
You know, for my part, it just all goes back into the Owl Research Institute. And I think some of the teachers have donated their money back to the Owl Institute. The artists usually get paid or they get to keep their artwork.
Do you know what distribution you're getting? I'm just trying to think of the impact of this sort of stuff.
You know, I honestly, I don't know. We just know that the first children's book was all over the United States in national parks and refuge systems.
And it's called, and do you remember the title?
The first one's Owls Who Are They with two O's. And the second one is Snowy Owls Who Are They with two O's. But we work with a local publisher in Montana, Mountain Press Publishing Company, the first series of children books, and they've been so successful that they're continuing with other groups of animals as well. And then from there, we do things like we offer a day in the field, where the public can join us in the field and watch us do our research. So that's been very successful, particularly with adults.
Now, you say particularly with adults. That surprises me. Why adults? There's a big push, as you, I'm sure, are well aware of, get kids out, get them to understand nature, the generations being raised in front of television sets. Why adults?
Well, first of all, that's part of our mission. We want to get more adults involved. Adults are the voting public, and adults don't get as much attention when it comes to outdoor education. Most of the stuff is for kids, and I think that's great. And I just see a void for adults, and we try to want to fill that void and get more and more adults out. And you'd be surprised how many adults enjoy to come out and learn in the field.
Roughly, if you're taking a group out, how many people going with you if you're doing it in an educational context?
If we offer for like the Audubon societies, very often they'll put it in their newsletter, and 60 people will show up. And then sometimes it'll be 6 or 8 or 10 people. It depends. We donate a day in the field to so many community fundraisers in all of Western Montana, whether it's a hospital fundraiser or if it's an aging services fundraiser or something like that. And in those situations, it can be anywhere from 2, 5, 10 people or so. They'll come out. It will kind of show them what we do, either doing the banding or something like that. And then we do a whole lecture on what research is about, why we study the species, what's the significance of it, and then talk a little bit more in depth, things like adaptations.
So what makes you think all that effort is worthwhile in some way, that it sticks?
You know, it's really hard to evaluate that. It is. And I think for me, it's the feedback that you get from people. Of course, you know, I'm a believer in, you know, the old adage, if you tell me, I might forget, involve me, and maybe I'll remember a little bit, but really get me involved and I might understand. So I kind of believe in that. But the way we get the feedback from the general public is when you go somewhere and people come up to you and they say, oh, I remember we went out in the field with you and it was just so good. And now I have a total new appreciation of owls. But not only that, they said, we now actually can go out and locate them and learn and watch them and things like that. That's when you know it's starting to stick. With so many people that you do education programs for, you know, you get a feedback by only a few, but you have to judge it by that.
Yes.
When I go over here to the local restaurant and I may sit down with a couple of the farmers and the ranchers and have a beer with them, they'll be talking to us and say, hey, you know, there's an owl over at my place. Anytime you want to come down there, you can do that. Well, you know, 10 years ago when we moved here, we weren't accepted like that. And it's all a matter of getting the people involved and taking our time as researchers to go to them, because they're not responsible to go to us.
It's a very interesting comment you just made, farmers and ranchers. Now, historically, when I was a kid, farmers and ranchers often shot predatory birds routinely, and rural people did too. So for that incident that you just described reflects a change in attitude. Now, have you witnessed that yourself?
Oh, for sure. Even though some of it still goes on, it definitely has slowed down. I mean, a ton. If you think about the Mission Valley here, 1966, there was an invasion of snowy owls, or a big eruption, migration eruption, we call it. And so there were snowy owls all over the valley. Well, everybody's got a stuffed snowy owl in their house, okay? Well, 2006, about 30 years later or so, what we saw up here in the Mission Valley was another big eruption of snowy owls in the valley, and everybody was out there just looking at them. So you could see that change right there. And so times have changed, yeah.
Your website suggests involvement in some TV natural history series. Is that a large component of your educational outreach, or how would you describe it?
I don't know about a large component, but we've done a number of programs. You know, I mean, all the major networks, ABC, NBC, CBS. We've worked with David Attenborough's Life of Birds. We've worked with the BBC. We've worked with Japanese Broadcasting Company Natural History Unit, Norwegian Broadcasting Natural History Unit, some South American Broadcasting Company. I mean, so we've done a lot of that. And most recently, we've worked on the sequel to the Planet Earth series, which is called Frozen Earth, that is produced by the BBC as well. And if you remember that series, the Planet Earth series was probably the most watched television piece on Earth that's ever been out.
Now, let me ask you, because you started by saying at one level there's not a lot of research into owls, but there's a lot of interest in owls. And what you just described in terms of television interest, and TV tends to run toward popular subjects, suggests there's a lot of interest in owls. So why the dichotomy between media interest, public interest at a certain level, 60 people showing up here to go out on owl workshops, and lack of research funding or lack of popularity of research? How do you see that difference?
I think it's because owls are hard to study. I think that's one of the big things. Most of them are nocturnal or nearly so. And, you know, they're kind of widely spaced. So they can be a particularly difficult group of birds to study. And a lot of people don't want to be out at night studying things. So I think that kind of eliminates a lot of researchers. Every species has got a few people that dedicate their lives to it. But there's just not a heck of a lot of researchers. And I think it's just because it's so difficult to study them and find them and work in those conditions and then study them for long periods of time. Now, on the other hand, from a public's interest, people have recognized owls since the cave art you described earlier in the Paleolithic period, 10,000 plus years ago.
Right.
And so there's always been an interest in owls by people in general. And again, I think it's the familiarity, how they look like us. So people like them. And then when you offer it in programs like we do, you show it on TV, the public's kind of interested in looking at them because they're neat looking animals. And they fall in a group of animals in the world, is owls. There's penguins, there's bears, there's animals like that that are more appealing to the public than others. And owls fall right in the top group.
Ultimately, someone might say that one of the purposes of this type of research is to help in the conservation of the species being studied specifically, or the natural world. Do you have any sense for that, whether this work that you've done has any impact on the management or conservation of owls?
You kind of always hope that when you're doing it. You hope that the people who manage our natural resources are reading the papers and, you know, incorporating some of that. Most recently, the best example we saw was just in the Missoula Valley, where we've done much of our research, where the land conservation groups who are trying to preserve some of the old grasslands west of Missoula have come to us and asked us about our data set because it's 23 years and what's going on with long-eared owls, a grassland species out there. And then in addition to that, what else have you recorded? Well, we've recorded all the birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, even a number of the plants out there. So here is finally, you can kind of see it working in a conservation perspective where the people who want to preserve the land have come to us and said, can you share your data with us? Because we haven't published it all yet. We've published some of it. So that's good. And now I think with the snowy owls and climate change, that's the next thing. People are coming, well, what's going to go on with snowy owls as the climate continues to change or warm? How will they be affected? Well, it's all guessing game right now. But what we're trying to say is, okay, these are the things we have to think about. So I think on a larger perspective, by looking at owls, which are a popular group of animals, we can provide information that may help in conservation of larger landscapes. And I mean it from a perspective where you work together with people, you know, not that you say, okay, this is off limits and that's that, like the Arctic refuge, you know, you take something like that. It's not necessarily that these animals can't adjust to some oil rigs, but it's what comes with it. So you need to work together on these things. And we're starting to see that now after all these years. And that's where the long-term data sets come in.
Now, you've been at it for 25 years. You've had the Institute for 20. That's how you've spent your time. How will you look back on it and why?
How will I look back on it? For me, personally, it's a great life. I enjoy learning wildlife in general, conservation in general, all aspects of it. Owls just attract me a little bit more than most of the other groups of animals. So, no, I'll just look back on it as time well spent. Yeah, there's times when I get up and I gosh, you know, you're working, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks on end without a day off. But, you know, if I can get some of the papers out, get some of the books out that we have in plan, and have it be useful, and then teach and convey the message and use owls as a conservation tool, but again, balancing it, you know, with compromise when we have to compromise and then, you know, stay firm, we have to stay firm. I don't know, I think I'm going to look back on it if it doesn't kill me, you know, just in stress alone as a good thing. You know, right now I still love it. I couldn't think of anything better to do. Plus, I get to guide and go all over the world, lead natural history tours, and took a chance, more guts than brains, and it seems to have worked out.
Denver Holt, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity, Ryan. Thanks very much.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is a production of Artemis Common Ground, which is solely responsible for the views expressed. Carmen Mowbray is our producer. Contact us at P.O. Box 748, Helena, Montana, 59624, or email brian.con at earthlink.net. Home Ground is in part made possible by grants from the Norcross Wildlife Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging discussion of ideas, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.